Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hello, and welcome to the Parenthood Podcast. Today I'm interviewing the writer of one of my favourite books. The Wild Other is a coming-of-age memoir, a defiant story of motherhood and love in the face of loss. Clover Stroud's mother fell from her horse while Clover was just 16. The brain injuries she sustained meant that while her mother hadn't died, she kind of had. The Wild Other charts Clover's life as she adjusts to her new normal, falls in and out of love, and becomes a mother herself. I loved The Wild Other. I really did. I think it's one of the most important books that I've read. I feel I read it. It was one of those sort of life changers. And I know that sounds really, really silly to say. But I was asked actually recently to name three books that changed my perspective on parenting. And The Wild Other was definitely one of them.
So nice to hear that. Thank you.
But I love it. I mean, it's a story ultimately of a kind of sort of coming of age memoir, I guess. It's autobiographical.
Definitely.
But really centers around the accident that your mother had, and finally the sort of end of her life. So she had a riding accident.
Yeah. So mum, I was 16 when mum had a riding accident. I was in the first term of my A-levels, and I'd grown up with ponies and a very kind of idyllic country childhood, I suppose. And mum went riding one morning, and I went to school to go and I'd just started my A-levels, and then my sister Nell came into class and said that, you know, mum had an accident. And at that time I thought, oh, she's probably broken her leg. It's very normal when you ride horses and ponies to kind of break your arm or break a leg. But she had fallen from her horse, and she'd taken the full blow of the accident on her head. And she was in a coma for about 3 to 4 months. And when she slowly woke up, it was... it sort of became clear over actually quite a long period of time that she wasn't going to recover at all. So in the first few weeks and months and even years, we felt that we could look after her, and with, you know, rehabilitation, physical and mental rehabilitation, and a lot of love, we could kind of look after her, I suppose, and that she would make some kind of recovery. But she wasn't able to talk or communicate at all, and she could walk to start with. In the first couple of years, she could walk and she could kind of walk around, but then actually was in my early, I mean, for the first couple of years, she couldn't walk, she couldn't talk, she couldn't communicate, she couldn't look after herself. She was doubly incontinent. She developed epilepsy. She didn't understand what was going on at all. But we did have her living at home kind of with nurses. And I'm the youngest of five, and I was still living at home at school. But after a couple of years, it became clear to us that she needed full-time mental and physical rehabilitation and care. And actually that rehabilitation wasn't really possible, that she needed full-time nursing. So she went into first a rehab centre and then into nursing homes. And she was in that state for 22 years until she died in 2013 when I was in my late 30s. So it was a long, long period. It was, you know, over 2 decades of her being alive but sort of dead at the same time, or a completely different version of herself. And she had been a very loving, incredibly loving, gregarious, funny, sweet mother, a lovely mother. And I was really close to her. And then having to kind of change my relationship with her, I suppose, and come to terms with a mother who couldn't do any mothering, who I couldn't have any sort of relationship with, and who also was really suffering and in pain, in mental and physical pain, was incredibly difficult for everybody, most of all for her. I mean, I think one of her tragedies is that she did have some sense of what had happened. I don't think she ever knew who I was. She never really knew again what was happening, but she did know that something there was some change, and that was very difficult.
You mentioned the fact that your relationship with her didn't end, but it changed, and I wonder whether that would have been harder than had it just simply ended, that sort of clean break of...
Yes, and that's one of the things that I write about in the book, actually, is that, you know, if she had died, it would have been a terrible tragedy. She was in her early 50s, and that's way too young to die. But it would have also... There would have been the process of grieving and bereavement to go through, which is an important process. But as it was, she was gone, but she wasn't gone. She was still there. So I couldn't... I mean, I don't know, you know, I wasn't able to sort of get over it, I suppose. And if she had died, there would have been some kind of finality. There would have been... there wouldn't have been a long term. I don't think there would have been the long term trauma that there was around going and having to see Mum in nursing homes and seeing her so altered and also suffering and upset, and the circumstances of her life utterly, utterly changed. And that was, you know, it was like pressing pause on a trauma. It didn't really stop. And I suppose that was what motivated a lot of the events that I write about in the book. And it motivated me to do things and live in a certain way that I might not have done had she not had the accident, or had she died, possibly.
One of the things that really struck me was when you brought your children in to see her. And there was, I've sensed a sort of sadness, real sadness, that she didn't really acknowledge them. And it wasn't that she didn't or she chose not to. Obviously, she couldn't. But that must have been awful.
I think that being a mother who doesn't have a mother is one of the most difficult things a woman can go through, actually. And I did have a mother, but she couldn't be a mother or a grandmother to my children at all. And she was very, very maternal, and she'd always really looked forward to me as the youngest having children. And she really enjoyed the grandchildren that she did meet before the accident, my elder sisters and brother's children. So when I first went in with my newborn baby, who's now 18, Jimmy, and I was so proud of him, you know, like all new mothers, I was so delighted with this tiny baby. And the nurses in the nursing home were so sweet and kind, and they all made a fuss about him. But when Mum saw him for the first time, she actually sat on her hands, which was a very strange kind of reaction of rejection. I mean, or maybe, I don't know what she was thinking of. Maybe she was shocked that I had a baby. Sometimes I think that she kind of remembered me as a child, you know, in her very brain damaged state. Maybe she remembered me as a young child and she was shocked as to why I was bringing a baby in. I don't know. I've speculated and tried to work out what she was thinking so often in my life. But you know, through all of my, I've got five children now, and four of them had been born. Three of them were born by the time she died. When she died, I was pregnant with my fourth, so she never actually met the fourth and the fifth children. And they were used to going and visiting her in a nursing home and playing on the floor with puzzles. As she just would sit in a chair. She couldn't talk. She couldn't. You know, she didn't really want to touch them or be with them at all. But the nurses, I have to say, it's, you know, the nurses in the homes where she were really, really wonderful. But yes, it was, you know, missing out on that kind of grandmother relationship. And as a mother, you know, mother to mother, mother to daughter relationship, I mean, was a real, real major sadness for me. And I still feel, when I see mothers of my age with their children and then with the grandmothers, I always I feel incredibly jealous. I really do. I feel almost, you know, green-eyed monster jealous. It's a relationship that I really, really bitterly miss. I wish that she had had that. I wish I'd had that. And I wish my children had had that as well.
It's one of the things I often say on the bump class is that when you have a baby, you kind of need to be mothered. And there's a lot of chat about how you can set up and help. And I would say, listen, I remember one of the most important things was going to stay with my mother when Ludo was born. Mm. And it was just so lovely not having to do anything apart from look after my baby, but also have someone to talk to. And I remember thinking, God, you did this 3 times. How did you do it? And so I think, you know, that is obviously an environment in which you really then miss the...
Definitely. And I think that, I mean, I'm really close to my dad and I've got an incredible stepmother. I'm really, really lucky. But nobody knows you like your mother does. And nobody knows you as a little baby and a young child as your mother does, I suppose. And my sister Nell said something that the version of who you are to your mother, you are not that version of a person to anybody else. So when you don't have your mother, that sort of the person that you are as a daughter of a mother is, it can't express itself in a way, which I thought was a really important thing to say. And I would, you know, I've often, my eldest is 18, my youngest is 2. I've gone through a lot of mothering and there's so many things I would love to have spoken to her about. And, you know, the normal worries, the normal anxieties and the normal joys of being a mother. I've never been able to say, is this what I did? Or what was it like for you? What did you find hard? I'd love to know if she had, I mean, I know she loved having children. I know she loved being pregnant. She gave us a real sense that childbirth was something extraordinary, and I think that I inherited that. I was lucky. I'm lucky to have 5 really, really great births, but I've had difficulties as well. I've had 3 miscarriages, and I've had postnatal depression really quite badly several times. So I would love to share the joy with her, but I would also love the advice, and I'd love to be able to talk to her about some of the more difficult, challenging elements of mothering as well.
I think, you know, too, what I always felt, and this is actually with my siblings and my mother, that sometimes your family are the only ones that can be brutally honest with you. And I remember so well a conversation I had with my mother when shortly after Willem, my son, was stillborn, and we were deciding whether or not we should have another baby, and if so, what the risks were. And I'd even considered the idea of surrogacy because it was difficult for me to have another baby safely. And I remember her saying to me, Marina, you have so much on your plate. You have so much more than so many other people already. But also, your children need so much emotional support. And if you think it's tough now juggling 2 children, just wait until they're emotional teenagers.
Yes.
And because I'd lost a baby, very few people could go, come on, Marina, you have so much.
Yes,
and yet,
really important.
It wasn't a conversation I wanted to hear. It wasn't the answer I wanted from her. I really wanted her to go, darling, of course you must have another baby, whatever it takes. And it wasn't that. And I'm so grateful that she was honest.
Yeah.
Did you have that relationship with your sisters? Did you find that that sort of female, because obviously your sisters are a little bit older, some of your sisters are a bit older.
Yeah, so my oldest sister, Emma, is about 15 years older than me, and I'm very, very close to her. And then I've got another sister called Nell, who is a couple of years older than me, and another brother and a sister who are a bit older. But those are the 2 siblings that I've spoken to mostly about parenting. And Emma and I, although she's older and her youngest son and my oldest son are the same age, which has been really, it was a complete joy. And I have to say, quite a surprise for me to have young children at the same time. And it was a great source of comfort, definitely. And, you know, it's parenting or mothering with your sister is, I suppose, the kind of best substitute for mum. I'm sure that you experience this as well with your sister, and knowing, you know, the pleasures of just kind of hanging out. We all know that, you know, there's quite a lot of elements of bringing up kids, which is quite monotonous, and you're doing the same thing again and again, and you spend a lot of time at the school gates or in the kitchen or waiting for them to finish their activities or their food or their reading. And having another woman to do that with is a real joy, and it does make it, it makes it more fun, doesn't it? It makes it more of a laugh. It makes it more interesting. It makes it, you know, there's consolation at the difficult times. And
it makes it less lonely.
Yeah, definitely. Parenting is really, really lonely. I've got five children and my husband is away a lot working, and I know that I can be on my own with my kids, who I absolutely adore, and feel and I'm, you know, with five other people, there's five of them, but I can still feel quite lonely. I think that's quite a difficult thing to admit, actually. I don't think we feel we can admit that even with our own children we can feel lonely as adults, definitely.
Well, a person is not a person unless they can have a conversation with you. And I mean, in your book, you describe home feeling a bit like a prison, that once it had been this sort of, you know, solace, you know, somewhere where you felt safe and happy. And, you know, I think particularly with a baby, when you're slightly bound to the house because you're feeding the whole time.
Yeah, absolutely.
It can actually feel like you're a prisoner in a very nice prison.
In a nice prison. No,
lovely wallpaper.
That's what I felt like after I had my third child. And I'd had two children in my 20s, and then in quite a difficult marriage. And then I got divorced, and I didn't necessarily think I'd have more children, but I met Pete, who I'm married to now. And I had another baby in my mid-30s, and a happy relationship and a nice home. And I was working as a journalist. Everything was great. And people would say to me, oh, you know, you must be so happy now. Everything's worked out after the kind of the sort of messiness that it was before. And I was in the early stages of postnatal depression, and I kept thinking, yeah, I must be happy. You know, I've got everything that I ever wanted, and yet I feel like I am in prison. I feel more and more shut in, literally, to the house. But then this is what postnatal depression did to me. It shut me in. You know, it shut me into myself, and it was as though everyone else was living a life right beside me. My children, my husband, we were on holiday with friends, and that feeling of a kind of shutter coming down, of watching the rest of the world through a pane of glass, is terrifying, terrifying feeling. And so confusing, because it happens at a time when you have a lovely baby and you have so much to be grateful for, and yet the kind of darkness of it is scary, is really scary. And I wrote very openly about it in the book, because I had it with Evangeline, my daughter, who's now six, and then I had it again with my son Dash, who's four, and with my fifth child, Lester, I had to make a really concerted effort to kind of fight it off and push it away, even though I knew exactly what it was. I knew exactly how to kind of deal with that, I suppose, which for me was the kind of normal things like CBT and exercise and diet and sleep. And I also had some acupuncture, actually, with my youngest, Lester. But I had to really, in a very, very conscious way, I had to kind of push it away from me. And it was like water lapping up at my ankles. It was there.
I want to read just a little paragraph. Do you mind?
No.
I do find like a kind of dweeb reading from your book. But I just think that this really articulates what people explain to me postnatal depression is like. You say, but there was also something nameless and murky, imprecise in shape, yet as hard as flint inside me. I was living a version of me, but it felt like the real me was watching, judging from a distance. I think that is such an amazing description of something that people find very, very difficult to describe.
Mm. Somebody said that expression, being beside yourself, you know, when we talk about somebody being beside themselves, and it's usually used to articulate a kind of sense of hysteria, but actually being beside yourself is the kind of most succinct description that I can see for postnatal depression, because it is though you are literally watching yourself all the time. And that sense that your voice becomes, I felt like I could hear my voice in my head, and I could hear my voice in my head, because also with the with postnatal depression came that kind of anxious chatter of I'm not a good enough mother, and I'm a failure, and I'm not doing this right. That kind of ticker tape of voice that goes, that sort of overrides all of the stuff you're doing in that external world, the kitchen as you're making pasta or whatever it is you're doing for your kids. That voice that I had in my head was awful and it's very scary. And in fact, on the train here, when I came to meet you, I was reading a book about postnatal depression, and just remembering it makes me feel kind of a certain tremor inside, I suppose. And the thing that I think is so important to articulate to other mothers who are going through it, and a couple of friends of mine who had been through it and could see what was happening to me, two friends, Sophie and Tiff, identified it and said, I think this is what's happening to you. And they would regularly send me messages saying, it's okay, it's going to pass. Because the feeling that you are trapped inside it and, oh my God, you know, this is now my life. What have I done to myself? I'm never going to be able to get out. Is very, very scary. And that kind of claustrophobia, that sort of claustrophobic feeling of being trapped in or in a prison that you're not going to be able to kind of claw your way out of, is one of the things that is most frightening. And reassuring women that it will pass. Identifying what it is really important.
Well, I was going to say, when your friends talk to you, did you immediately think, oh yes, of course, that's what it is? Or did you deny it and say no, don't, because I know that is one of the symptoms, is denial.
Yeah, I didn't with Dash because I'd had it before, but with Evangeline, my third, I did deny it because I also I wanted, when I had Jimmy and Dolly, who are 18 and 15 now, I was, after I split up from their dad when they were very young, I had a kind of life where I continued to travel and adventure very, very kind of actively, I suppose. And it was partly enabled by the fact that I was a journalist. So I did some really exciting stories and I traveled a lot and I spent time in Russia. And so because I'd had them in my mid-20s, I was quite young compared to quite a lot of my friends from university. And when I had Evangeline, I wanted to say to myself and say to Pete, my husband, and say to anybody who was listening, there wasn't anybody listening, but if they were, I'd have said, my life's not going to change. I'm going to carry on living in this kind of adventurous way that I have with my first two kids as a single mother. I'm going to carry on living a life that is energetic and outdoors and that nothing has changed. So to the extent that when Evangeline was like 3 or 4 months old, I took her skiing, and I remember wearing salopettes and breastfeeding and walking around in ski boots. I'd have to walk right up this really, really steep hill to go back to the crash to pick her up from, you know, and then go and breastfeed her. And when I look back on it now, I think, you know, what were you trying to prove? Why were you making it so difficult? It wasn't, you know, so yes, you went skiing with a baby, but, you know, you didn't have to make it that difficult for yourself. You weren't proving anything. You know, it's not actually, I wish I could say to myself, just let yourself off the hook. You know, of course your life is going to change. You'll get back what you want. You'll be able to go and do things. And I still have to say this to myself now because my youngest is only 2. And sometimes I think, God, you know, am I going to be able to go away on my own ever again? Of course you get those things back. But that beginning bit, just be a bit easier. Just let yourself, you know, let time and the baby and milk and emotion wash through you and be present to it. And because it is, I know it's such a cliche, but it is a short time as well, and it does pass. And
and then you get to the stage where you just wish you could put a pause on their aging.
I know.
Wished those days away.
I know. And yet at the same time, there's that expression that the days go slowly and the years go quickly, I think is really good, because I know what it's like. You know, it's kind of 3:45 in the afternoon, and it's like another 3 or 4 hours until bedtime, and you've got lots of small children to entertain, and time can seem to kind of turn into a soupy, slow syrup that moves nowhere but backwards at that point. And it's frustrating and it's boring, and yet, you know, my son's just been 18. My tiny little baby is now 18, and it has gone quickly. It's gone quickly and it's gone slowly. And I think that's one of the, and as a mother, you're also always told to enjoy every single moment. And there was that awful thing going around on social media about, your children have only got 18 summers, you know, let that, you know, really you should appreciate every moment. And it's like, well, yes, you can, but there's
18 summers are still long.
Quite a lot of summers. And no other state are we told, women told, you must enjoy every moment of your career, you must enjoy every moment of your holiday or your marriage or your dinner or whatever it is. But with motherhood, we put this pressure on ourselves to be loving it all. And it's not it's sort of not really human to love every single second of something, and I certainly do not love every second of it. And I think it's great that there is now more dialogue and more openness about saying, actually, it's really difficult, it's really boring, and I'd like to be doing something different. And also saying, I love it too, because I do. I absolutely I love being a mother, and it brings, I can't.
Well, obviously you did. You did it 5 times. You've got 5 kids.
I love being a mother. I do love it. And I also find it incredibly difficult and incredibly boring, and wish that I could run away quite a lot of the time as well.
Will you have a sixth?
No. I have to say the jump from 4 to 5 was really, really, in terms of where is everybody, what are everybody's needs, was really kind of, I find that made me feel quite crazy, and it still does make me feel quite crazy. Yesterday at tea time, they all came into the kitchen, and the 2-year-old, 4-year-old, 6-year-old, 15-year-old, 18-year-old all asking me completely different things and needing me in a completely different way. And, you know, you feel like you're kind of cracked into lots of pieces as well. So no, I don't think I will. I mean, I think I did want to have 5, and I do kind of like the sort of the messiness of it. I kind of, after I had 4, people said, well, you know, you've got 2 boys and 2 girls from each sort of each dad, I suppose, it's all really perfect. But motherhood isn't perfect, and in a way I wanted to sort of make it messier, I suppose. And I certainly did that with the 5th one. It is very it's chaotic, yeah.
Well, chaos is fun.
Yeah.
I love a bit of chaos.
Yeah.
I also love knowing it will end, because, I mean, I definitely have a house
really
that... I often have people in this house, I often have my kids, my sister's children. Mm. And I've got to say, I absolutely love the chaos. Mm. But then I also like a bit of breathing space,
yeah,
where you just think, okay, I can actually do something for myself.
Yeah. Have the thoughts that you need to have, and have the... I mean, that's something that I've been writing about in another book. I'm writing a book about motherhood, is the fear of when I was pregnant with my 5th, there's a lot of time to think, which I'm not going to have now, and having to kind of reconcile yourself to that, I suppose, with a young baby, and
have the time to put into your relationship.
Yeah, which is really, really hard, and is so important. Mm. I mean, it's so, so important. And we go through weekends where we can barely finish a sentence, you know, with each other, let alone finish a conversation. And when we go away, occasionally when we've had, you know, a night away, I feel very grateful. I feel very grateful that I still do really want to talk to Pete, and I love being with him, and I love talking to him. But it is so important to try and make that time. It's really, really very difficult.
Well, and I think often at the end of the day, or especially at the end of a weekend, you're so exhausted that all you want to do is flop in front of the telly and eat dinner off your lap, which... Obviously, like you said, the communication is so important. It's so important to keep on talking, but it's so tempting just to say, oh, I'll do it tomorrow night.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that is something that people with 1 child struggle with, let alone 5.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that the, when I was working as a journalist, I wrote lots of articles. I quite often wrote relationship articles or articles about sex. And one of the things I was always asked to write about was infidelity, and why do people have affairs? And I was, So I interviewed quite a few different relationship people, and like Andrew G. Marshall. There was various different people. And the thing that they all say is the communication is the really important, you know, that's what really matters. And when someone has an affair, it's very, very rarely about sex. It's actually just about wanting somebody to talk to and being heard and being acknowledged. And one of the things that he said is that, you know, even you can communicate to each other that you're having difficulty communicating. Say to each other, okay, I know at the moment because you're working away a lot, or one of the children's doing their GCSEs, or we don't have as much time for each other, but we will do later on. And it's something that Pete and I say to each other quite a lot. This is an intense time. You know, the youngest is only 2 and he's away working a lot. And kind of acknowledging that you are there for each other as well, even when you sort of can't see each other in the demands of work life and family life as well, I think is really, really, really important, definitely.
Because your relationship is a bit like, you know, you're a team, so you're working together as well as married to each other and lovers. But I think often when you've got those two relationships, you get into the stage where you communicate in the sort of need to know, like, who's getting the kids, me or you, have you packed lunch?
You become carers, basically. Exactly, yeah. You live together.
But then you get to the stage where if you've communicated that, you think, okay, we've got nothing more to talk about. Yeah. And obviously that is nothing. That's not communication.
Yeah.
My husband had been away for 10 days and we had lunch yesterday, but we'd done that sort of basic communication. I was like, do we actually need to talk? And then you realize you have an hour lunch, you realize that there's a huge amount to talk about, but you don't realize until you give yourself the opportunity to actually do it.
To do it. Yes, I know. And the problem is the way, you know, the demands of our lives, most of our lives now, make finding that space, you know, really, really, really difficult. And but it's so important. And actually, you know, I know that there are some writers who've said, I love my husband more than my children. I'd save my husband in the burning house. I'm not saying that, but kind of pushing the children away, I think, as much as you can, almost, to give the relationship a chance to breathe and chance to live and chance to survive is really, really, really important. And if we are doing something on our own and I'm feeling guilty, I always think, well, you know, me and Peter are at the centre of this, and if we're strong, then they are kind of strong as well. Our strength together and our relationship will affect all of their happiness and their stability and their lives together.
Well, that's what they're going to thank you for at the end of the day. If in 20 years time you guys are still happy and provide a
that
home where they can come home,
chief.
You know, they're not going to care about whether you did a weekend football match with them.
Yeah,
you know, that is all by the by.
Yes, yeah. Yeah.
You guys, that hub, and it's not always easy. How did he find coping with your postnatal depression? Because I think that can be really hard for men to understand. And I hope that there are some men listening to this podcast who might just want to generate a bit of more of an understanding, because it's so difficult when you think, we have everything. We have a baby.
What's
Why
wrong?
Aren't you happy?
I know. Be
How
happy,
could you not be
enjoy
happy?
It. No, I know. I'm really lucky that Pete is very emotionally evolved, and he is very, he's quite female in a way that he will really talk about emotions. And when I met him, I actually met him first at university, but we only knew each other a little bit, and then we met again in my early 30s. And our relationship was formed around talking. We talked to each other, and we talked to each other for several months before we slept together, before we kind of had sex together. And having that communication was really, really important. And he knew that I had two quite young children. Jimmy and Dolly were about 5 and 9 when we met. And he also knew, and Mum was still alive at that point. And she died. So I met Pete in 2010 and she died in 2013. And we had Evangeline in 2012. So a lot of things happened early on in our relationship. But so he knew that I brought with me quite a lot of, you know, I hate that word baggage. And one boyfriend once said to me, oh God, you've got so much baggage, you need your own baggage handler. And I just feel like, yes, I've got baggage. You know, that's my life. I'm so proud of my baggage. But he never saw it as a kind of impediment or a problem. He was incredibly engaged with me and my emotional state, I suppose, right from the beginning. And the fact that I was a mother of two quite young children. So when I had depression, he's always been tuned into where I am, and I feel really lucky. And that's why, you know, talking to each other is so important, not just living together and going through the motions together, but actually talking to each other and being present with each other and seeing each other and communicating with each other. Because when I got depression, he also saw, I mean, Evangeline was born in September, and I remember December, he said, you're not okay, are you? This is really, really difficult. And he was incredibly understanding and incredibly loving and kind and patient. I think patience is one of the big things, isn't it? Because when somebody is depressed, you do want them to kind of it's an awful phrase, but you do want them to kind of snap out of it and pull themselves together, and so that you can get on with living your life together again. And he was very happy. He had a, you know, lovely, beautiful newborn baby, and everything seemed really wonderful. And but he was kind and he was patient, and I started having CBT, and that was really helpful. And he kind of talked to me. He kind of did CBT on me, I suppose. I don't want that to sound creepy, but he would talk to me about what, you know, my spiraling thought process, and he would kind of help me to still it and help me to understand it.
Did he have, had he had any training? Had he had any advice about how to talk to you, or was this just instinctive?
He's just, no, he hadn't, but he is a very communicative person. So he's kind of in touch with his emotions, definitely. And I think I would have found it much harder to, it would have been harder if I was with somebody who was more brisk and, you know, didn't have that kind of, wasn't articulate in that way, I suppose. And therefore, I think also finding professional help, if necessary, like CBT or a very good friend who you can talk to about what you're going through, or if you've identified that you have postnatal depression, talking to someone else who has had it as well, I think is really, really, really helpful.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Did you find, I mean, you mentioned that with Lester, you sort of managed it in a slightly different way. Mm. By then the book had been published and you talked openly about you having postnatal depression. Do you think that helped? The fact that you'd sort of opened up to the world and said, actually, this is what happened to me.
Yeah.
Did you find that was...
Yes, I think that it was helpful. And I've definitely found, you know, one of the things that's been a real joy about the book actually is through, largely through social media, people have contacted me and said, I share this experience, and it might be grief, it might be loss of a mother, it might be postnatal depression, or it might be some of the, you know, the book is also about very much about living and loving and travel and the joy of life as well. And so some people were also contacting me saying, you know, I loved, you know, the idea of adventurous travel, for example. And that's been a real pleasure, kind of sharing other people's experiences, I suppose. And the book, when you say something publicly like that, and the book is very confessional and it's very open, and I haven't held anything back, and I talk about all of the mess of my life as well as the excitement I've had, people have responded very openly and very kind of passionately, actually, because sometimes I think I've articulated something that they may not have fully understood in themselves as well. And I think postnatal depression is one of those big ones that it's difficult. It's so confused. Postnatal depression is so confusing.
Well, I think a lot of people don't realize they've got it.
Yeah.
It goes undiagnosed. I mean, Chiara says that whenever, you know, she sees a lot of postnatal depression in her practice, and she said, you know, she once met a woman whose child was 15.
Really?
And had had postnatal depression, and for basically the entirety of that child's life. And she said that's the saddest thing, because if we are more educated and more informed about picking it up, because it's usually the family that pick it up, it's not the doctor. When you go for your 6-week check and they're like, how are you feeling? You're like, fine, which means not fine at all.
Yeah.
that, you know, that's the real sadness. So it's actually so important we talk to.
Well, I find it really, I find that statistic that it's something like 1 in 10 women suffer. I'm sure
they think it's more, actually.
A lot more than that.
They think between 15% and 30%.
Yeah.
Because it's just, it is quite undiagnosed. Yeah. And I wonder whether it affects different demographics more.
Mm.
You know, I wonder whether the older mother maybe puts more pressure on herself because she sort of worked out how to live life and think she's got
totally.
It all sorted.
I can, because, you know, the idea that mothering is easier when you're older. I had 2 children in my 20s and, I mean, speaking from experience, my 20s were quite chaotic and all over the place and I didn't really know what was happening, and I got married and had 2 children during that time. And then when I had more children in my late 30s, where life was ostensibly much better organised and I was in a really happy relationship and, you know, my work was going well, everything was a little bit more stable, if life ever is stable. I mean, I don't think it ever really is stable, but it was much, much more difficult because I had a more ingrained sense in my late 30s of how I wanted things to be. And a baby is like, you know, it brings a huge amount of chaos and uncertainty and that kind of the chaotic and the relentless chaos of a baby as well sort of fitted in with my 20s a bit better than it did in a way with my 30s. So I'm always saying to my younger nieces and particularly my nieces who are in their 20s are always saying, have babies earlier. You know, I think there is, I don't know, it's difficult because in your 20s, quite often your relationship isn't the right one. But I think there is a lot to be said for having them quite early.
Or maybe just, you know, more of the dialogue around the fact that, you know, of embracing that chaos and that just because your house is tidy and your dress sense is better than it was and you've worked out what hairstyle suits you doesn't mean you've worked life out.
No.
And
no.
That actually you're about to, you know, embrace this whole new chapter, which you're not going to have a clue of what to do. So you've got to embrace the chaos.
Mm. Mm.
Not to expect life to be able to continue in your little perfect bubble that you've managed to sort.
Yeah, I think that there should be more kind of, and I guess this is what you do and why it's so valuable, there should be more coaching for women around how chaotic it is going to be, actually. And not just that you're not going to, you know, get the sleep, you're not going to be able to drink a hot cup, you know, make and drink a hot cup of tea is a very difficult thing to do when you've got a young baby.
And you think it's such a simple thing.
I know,
wish
and it
for.
Should
it's all
be.
I want.
Just a cup of, to make my own cup of tea and actually drink it or have a shower.
Well, I often think, I just need to go to the loo on my own.
No, I know.
Just 2 minutes, guys, just 2.
But I mean, I still get that with my teenage children. I'm in the bathroom and they just, you know, wander upstairs. Mom, what are you doing? And I think that, and also this is like one of the challenges of social media as well, because Instagram can give you this idea that it can, you know, it should be in this sort of perfect or organized or very groovy way, which it isn't.
Effortless too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And more kind of understanding of how the chaos will affect you and how sleeplessness will affect you. My children still wake up in the night or they come and get into bed with me in the night, and it's a long-term kind of chronic tiredness as well that you do also just learn to sort of live with, I suppose, but that it does kind of change you in a sense, and you have to learn ways of, you know, of sort of accommodating it in your life. There was a lovely girl helping me with the kids in the summer who's 20, and she, you know, there was a few disturbed nights when the kids were up, and she was saying, oh, I'm just so exhausted, I can't believe how exhausting this is. And I thought, God, well, try it like when you've been doing it for 3 or 4 or 5 or 10 years and then see what the exhaustion is like. But it is lovely, you know, it is also joyful, it's life. I love the mess of it, and I love the kind of I don't know. I love the sort of unpredictability of it as well, and the colour of it.
And that ultimately is why there is a population crisis, an overpopulation crisis.
Yeah.
You know, if motherhood was really awful and not worth it, humans wouldn't exist.
Yeah.
But if actually the greatest threat this world is facing is that we love being parents too much.
Yes, yes, it's true. It's really true.
Back to the postnatal depression. I mean, what was the sort of time frame?
Well, with Evangeline, I find the first few weeks I feel absolutely euphoric and like Superwoman, and possibly looking back on it a little bit too euphoric, maybe. I love having a newborn baby. I love that sense. I love giving birth, actually, because it's such a weird, terrifying, extraordinary, awful thing to go through that I definitely see it as touching the sort of filter or the film between life and death. When you're giving birth, you're not in this room, you're in another space. And I think that in those first few weeks, I always feel like I'm kind of close to this otherworldly sort of magic. And I'm not saying I've had agonizingly painful, incredibly undignified births. I haven't like breathed my way through it very easily, but I do think it's an extraordinary and very kind of humbling, I suppose, thing to experience, childbirth. So I and then a newborn baby is so, they're quite sort of like aliens in a way. They're just so incredible. And I was watching a documentary about babies last night, and their strange movements and the way they move their mouths is wonderful. So in the first few weeks, I'm usually very happy, exhausted, I found breastfeeding difficult, although I have found it difficult. But when I had postnatal depression twice, it usually started, I guess, round about 6 to 8 weeks, when you're kind of the absolute newborn novelty, I suppose, is no longer that they start growing. They might have grown out of their first baby grows. You're back into a normal life, as it were, or this new normal, abnormal life. And I'm sure it's a big hormonal slump as well. I've been on a kind of hormonal high after the birth, and then suddenly there is a slump and exhaustion. And I found that it was from about 8 weeks for several. With Evangeline, I properly identified it about when she was about 2 months old, and it went on until, so that would have been November, and then by the spring I was beginning to feel slightly more normal. That coincided with the change in the weather, and of course that always makes you feel a little bit more optimistic. But 4 or 5 months, quite a long time, 6 months, I didn't then feel normal. I still struggled with moments of darkness, as I do yesterday. When all the children were shouting at me at tea time, I felt quite dark about motherhood at that moment, and I forced the younger ones to come out for a walk with me, and it was then lovely. So knowing that there are going to be, postnatal depression, I think, is something that all the kind of the moments of darkness remain. They are there even as the children get older. But the intensity of the depression was probably a few months. And then with Dash, who's now 4, it was a much shorter period of time. It was about 6 weeks of feeling really, 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 really bleak. Mum had died when I was pregnant with Dash, so I'm sure it was affected by that as well. But because I'd had it before, I kind of knew that CBT and going outside and forcing yourself to go and see somebody, talk to a girlfriend, have a cup of tea with your sister, whatever it is, even when you just really, really don't want to, because, the way that it shuts you into yourself, and then you don't want to communicate with people, exacerbates the problem, doesn't it? It kind of, it becomes self-fulfilling almost. So, and also getting out of postnatal depression is, even when you've identified it, it is a hard and it's not an immediate process. It's like one step forward, two step backs, maybe. It takes time, but knowing what it is makes it less scary.
Yeah, I was going to say, was it a relief when it was sort of diagnosed and you said, oh, well, this is why I'm feeling like this?
Yeah, I think that there is a relief. But although it's not as straightforward as that in a way, because you also still, the shame of postnatal depression and the feeling that I should be loving it and I should be so grateful and I've got a, I've got a lovely, healthy baby. I have nothing to be ungrateful for, is really, it's yet another pressure on a mother to, find fault with herself in a way. So admitting that I had postnatal depression was in itself quite upsetting, actually, and quite confusing. And then when I had it again, it definitely is a feeling of some kind of failure. And I think it's quite often, I believe that postnatal depression is quite often associated with a difficult birth as well. But I didn't have difficult births at all. So it isn't, you know, you can, I think it's easy to look at other people and think, oh, they're, you know, it's all been plain sailing for them because they're doing it this way, or they've got certain setup which works, or, but you can have, you know, an easier setup, or you can have a really good birth, or, and you can still, you know, you, it's still there. It's not, what I mean is you shouldn't be ashamed when it does happen. It happens to so many people. It's so common. I'm sure it's more, I do believe that lots and lots of people do have it in at some stage or another. So acknowledging it is really important. Definitely.
Did you talk about it to your older children? Because obviously they would have been aware that you weren't.
Well, it's interesting actually, because Dolly's 15, were watching a documentary about motherhood last night, and somebody was talking about postnatal depression. And Dolly said, "Oh, what is that?" And I felt so happy actually that she hadn't realised that I'd had it. And I think that, you know, that's one thing that you do as a mother, don't you?
Did you tell her that you'd had it then?
Yes, I did say I had it a little bit. Some, you know, it's a feeling that you can get. And I talked about hormones and tiredness, and that it's very common, and not to be afraid of it as well. But as a mother, so often we put a smile on and put the baby in the buggy and pretend that everything is okay as well. I definitely was pretending in a big way after Evangeline was born.
Which is exhausting.
It's exhausting, yeah. You know, it's kind of sends you, and that increased the, it sent me into a state of feeling quite mad, because I had the voice in my head saying you're a failure, and I was pretending to everyone else that I was absolutely fine, and trying to be in touch with your feelings, I suppose, and be honest about it is important at that point. But I was kind of surprised and relieved that she hadn't really noticed as well. And I think that, you know, I think our children I think that they often aren't so aware actually of what we're going through.
Well, maybe also they're just not as critical of ourselves as we are of ourselves.
Yes,
we are our own worst critics. And I certainly have days when I think I really failed today as a mother. I really did not score well in the sort of parenting stakes. But I doubt very much if my kids went to bed going, God, mummy was a real bad mother today.
Of course
they're just
don't.
Kind of grateful for life.
and they want you to read them a book or look at some little drawing they've done at school. And no, they won't be criticising, of course. And that inner critic that we have that says, oh God, I was a bad mother because you got impatient, or you didn't cook the supper that you wanted to cook, or
shouted,
or is, that's us, you know, that's very much us judging ourselves. It's not them. It's not really other people, I don't think, often as well.
Yeah. So obviously the book centres around your mother's awful riding accident, but horses continue to be a big feature in the book. In fact, I kind of felt like they sort of helped you process what you needed to go through.
Totally, yeah.
And I loved your descriptions of, I mean, you went and spent time in Texas being a cowgirl, and you were in Russia, but horses are this big theme throughout the book, which is quite interesting considering, you know, a horse was not to blame, but the fact that your mother was riding was the reason she wasn't able to be your mother anymore. Did you ever struggle with that?
Well, I grew up with ponies and sort of doing a lot of riding as a child. Quite scruffy. We weren't, you know, we just had kind of scruffy ponies kept out in a field where we lived in the country. And for me, and then Mum had an accident that was a riding accident. And for me, horses, I was 16 and ponies had been a huge source of excitement and solace and sweetness and comfort. Even just thinking about my pony, like the smell of, you know, that smell of a pony's their mouth, or when you've just given them a carrot, and that kind of I suppose it's quite a sensual relationship as a child, that feeling. And I can see it with my own kids now with their little Shetland pony, how much they love to snuggle her. And so for me to go back towards the ponies and the horses that I'd grown up with was absolutely natural. And I was 16 when Mum had her accident, and I was starting, well, I was actually, by the time she had her accident, I was quite well into all the kind of teenage thrills. And horses were, well, Nell and I, my sister Nell and I used ponies as a way of, we grew up in the country and we'd ride around to villages in the middle of the night, when this was before Mum's accident, when she didn't want to drive us somewhere, and go meet boys and go swimming in gravel pits. So horses were almost like a kind of form of liberation, as, you know, growing up in the countryside. And I can see that with my children, my elder children now, the teenage children, they always desperately want lifts somewhere or another. And so Nell and I used ponies to ride around, and they then became a kind of source of quite major, I suppose it was almost like pain relief, really. They were adrenaline and they were excitement. And I went to work for a racehorse trainer as soon as I finished school, before I went to university. And then I went and kind of was on the rave scene and lived with New Age travellers who were horse-drawn and was travelling around in a gypsy wagon. And then after university, I went to Texas and worked as a cowgirl, and horses were also passports into quite exciting worlds as well. I've always enjoyed going somewhere and working rather than traveling around, kind of working in a certain area. So going to Texas and working on a ranch was a way to meet cowboys was one thing,
because you were the only cowgirl.
Yeah. and also be out in incredible, and you know, incredible landscape, and doing something that was very sort of physically demanding and rewarding,
and risking. I mean, reading your book, there's,
yeah,
you were brave and quite reckless.
Yeah, I think, I mean, when I look back on it, I can see that I was riding Bronx. I was like breaking in ponies when I was in America and riding Bronx and getting bucked off a lot. And then later on, I in my late 20s, I met a trick. My sister's got a circus called Gifford Circus, and I met a trick rider in her circus, and he went back to Russia. So I followed him back to Russia into the Caucasus Mountains. That was quite dangerous, actually, I think, what I did there, because it was, I didn't speak Russian and he was pretty fiery, and it's a pretty exciting, fairly lawless part of the world in Ossetia.
And you went to Beslan, is that right?
Yeah, I was in Beslan. I mean, it was after the Chechen atrocity, but there was very much a sense of the kind of, you know, the melting point, the melting pot of the North Caucasus. And I had two young children at that stage as well, and I didn't ever take them over there, but I would, and I was a single mom, and it was very kind of full on mothering that I was doing at that stage, and I was supporting them on my own and looking after them completely on my own. But when I had some time away from them, and they were going to stay with their grandparents on my ex-husband's side, who are totally wonderful, I would go off and have adventures. And horses were a way of kind of riding into wild worlds, but also facing up to and facing down Mum's accident, because she was still alive, because the kind of, I describe it as like a kinetic energy, it's like kinetic trauma, i.e. it was kind of living beside me. She hadn't died. The trauma of what happened to her was still there. And
what was happening to her?
Yeah, exactly. And so horses were a way of going into battle with that trauma, I suppose, and saying, no, you're not going to win. I'm not going to allow this kind of horror that's happened to us all, and the destruction of, you know, a very, very happy home life and family life, destruction of my mother, destruction of my family almost. I'm not going to let it get the better of me. And so I felt like I was riding into the face of the danger. That's how I kind of metaphorically saw it, I suppose. And when I was writing the epilogue of the book, that became really clear to me, that it wasn't just kind of willfully self-destructive behaviour. It was actually trying to kind of to beat it. And horses gave me sort of excitement and escape and relief, and actually excitement and escape and relief from motherhood as well, because I could go and get on a horse, and you know, at that moment in the day when you're standing in the kitchen and you're surrounded by endless plates of carbohydrate and plastic of your children, and I have craved escape from that as well. And going and riding for me now as well, I have a pony that I ride. I can't say that I gallop off across the world in pursuit of Russian horsemen anymore, but I do like to go and ride as much as I can and be outside and just feel separate from my children as well. That feels quite important. And so, yeah, horses have always been this passport into different worlds. And when we left Oxford, when I'd had my fourth child, Dash, we moved out of Oxford and moved to Oxfordshire, to the, near the Ridgeway and the White Horse. There's an incredible 4,000-year-old chalk horse on the hill. And that was when I started writing the book. And I kind of, it was after Mama died, and I knew that there was a story to tell, really, about moving through grief and moving through trauma and becoming a woman, moving from a child to a woman and going through motherhood. And the white horse on the hill, this chalk horse, gave me a kind of the emblem, in a way, of what I'd been going through. It was very, very important, that moment of, and as I drive around, when I'm on the school run, I see the chalk horse every single day, and it's kind of reaffirmed this, the importance of horses in my life. And I mean, I don't do like very kind of swanky riding at all. I've got a little tiny scruffy Shetland pony, and then we've got a Welsh pony, and they just live out in a field all year round, basically. But I think it's also good for children to have that, you know, relationship with animals. I really like that too.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, reading your book, I sort of wonder, I just can't imagine the pain you were feeling while after your mother's injury and while she was in hospital, and that guilt, I'm sure.
Yeah.
And you know, that you hurled yourself into these experiences to try and maybe feel an emotion that was stronger than the guilt and the sadness that you were feeling.
Yeah, and to kind of definitely to escape from it.
And then obviously there was a big change in your life happened when you met Pete, and then when you had the children you had with him. But after your mother died, which was a really unexpectedly emotional part for me in the book, I think that was the time that I really sobbed in the book, when you described her death, which was ultimately was a blessing. I mean, the way you describe it is just incredibly beautiful. But I was really surprised at how emotional that was. It was, I guess it was a bit like you conveyed the release. And, you know, crying for us is a release. Did you find after she died, your relationship with risk and that sort of seeking the thrill and that intense emotion, do you think that changed because she was no longer in that awful limbo that must have been terrible to deal with?
Yeah, and I did have, and I was pregnant as well with Dash. I think that I'm 43 now, and I think that you know, your relationship with risk, it does change as you get older. And Mum's been dead for nearly just under 5 years. And I think during that time, for a while, I was carrying on and I was riding racehorses and I was kind of after it still, I suppose. But I think that in the last year, because one of the things that's been difficult is that Mum had this awful accident, which dominated a large part of my life. It also encouraged me, enabled me to go and live live life to the full. You know, I know it's a cliche, but I really feel like I have done. But and when something bad happens, it's easy to think, oh, it's, you know, lightning has struck, it's not going to strike again. But unfortunately, in the last year, there have been other accidents. My husband had a very, very, very bad accident a few months ago. And you know, as you get older, and I have lost people who are very, very, very important to me in the last year, and things have happened in life that have been difficult. And as you get older, I suppose, you know, you just through virtue, I suppose, of being of experience and being alive, more stuff happens to you that you have to process. And I thought that Mum's accident was the big bad thing that was going to happen to me. But of course, life isn't, you know, it doesn't work like that. It's not as sort of straightforward as that. And the funny thing about writing a book is that there's an ending to it. And of course, you know, luckily there isn't an ending at the moment. Life goes on, and it goes on being the complex, messy, difficult, extraordinary, beautiful thing that it is, you know, being a human being is. And so I guess, I don't know whether it's exactly mum dying or just the experience of life and having more children and my children being older. I guess that has probably changed my relationship with risk slightly. And also another thing that's been really important was my eldest child getting to the age that I was when mum's accident happened. So when Jimmy, who's now 18, got to 16, I felt in a blind panic that something was going to happen, or I was going to willfully do something to make something happen. And I suppose as you get slightly older, then the sort of preciousness of life becomes more apparent. And I feel deeply grateful for what I have at the moment. I feel really grateful for it. Life has proved itself to me in the last few years, as well as mum's accident, to be, you know, quite a perilous state to find oneself in a way, is to be a human being. And I feel really grateful for what I have, and I really do feel like I want to enjoy what I have. I want to live deeply, and I want to live, you know, in a rich and meaningful, spiritually rich way. But I want to enjoy my children, and I am enjoying most parts of motherhood. But I guess there'll always be something in me that likes the wild a bit. You know, I talk about touching the wild other in the book, and that's what horses give you a chance to do, is to kind of touch that sense of yourself, of who you are, separate from domestic life or separate from your work, something kind of atavistic and deep inside you. So I don't think risk will go away, but maybe it does mellow a bit. Yes.
The book is very, very honest. Mm. And I think, you know, most of us, we have wild parts of our lives that we don't necessarily document and can kind of tuck away as a secret somewhere. Whereas you've been very open about every aspect of your life. Will you encourage your children to follow like their wild others or?
Yes, I think that I do. I think that I can't pretend. I mean, I absolutely am not pretending that any of the wild stuff didn't happen. You know, I've written about it, and I'm writing another book now, which is also very open. And
have any of them read the book?
No, Jimmy's read bits of it, and there are certain bits, particularly about sort of teenage life and wildness, that he has read. But I don't know, I think your children are, I mean, in my experience, my children are not especially interested in who I am for my work, you know, although my work is absolutely who I am. But they want me as their mum and someone to muck around with and make supper for them, play games with them. But they don't really want to talk to me about what I'm writing about. In fact, I wrote an article recently for The Guardian about mothering, and they were in it, and they knew they were in it, and they were photographed for it, and Jimmy was quoted in it, and he read. I said, look, you need to read this before it's published. I just want you to know, I want to know that you're all cool with it. And he read half of it, and he said, yeah, that's absolutely fine. It's fine. So I think that they're not particularly interested by it. But I want them to have interesting lives. And I know that an interesting life isn't always, it's a kind of difficult life, actually. Lives with difficulties. I'm always drawn to people who've been through the difficult stuff and who want to talk about the difficult stuff. That's where we kind of grow and learn about each other as humans and about ourselves. And no life is going to be easy. Of course, you know, they're going to experience lots of challenges, and I would never want to keep them wrapped up in cotton wool. I'd never want to kind of keep them close to me for a sense of safety, I suppose. So I hope that they, in their own way, but I also wouldn't want to force them into doing stuff that they didn't want to do. I've got, some of them might not want to go and have that kind of life. All of them might not want to go and have that life, and that will be absolutely fine, as long as they're doing the thing that is true to them, I suppose, and which is kind of communicates what or is the version of themselves that they truly want to be, that they are, I think, trying to understand who they are and to be honest with themselves, and also to push themselves as hard as they can. That's, you know, to make the effort to do things to the best of their abilities. That is an important thing to encourage them to do, and also to have kind of grit and perseverance. I think those, you know, and tenacity that I've been trying to teach my son. I don't know whether it's a really good thing to teach, but I was thinking if you're trying to do something and there's some obstruction which is stopping you do it, you're not doing a bad thing, but you really want to do it, to know that when you're told no, this isn't, it's not possible to do that, you don't have to accept that you can, you know, there are ways to go and have the adventures or live the life or be the person that you want to be, even when it appears very difficult. And I guess that's what I'm trying to teach them, I suppose.
And also that, you know, sometimes those experiences that maybe aren't the best can also be really positive, because I know we all make mistakes in life, don't we? And those are probably arguably what culminate in the richest parts of our lives.
Yeah, definitely. In a way, the suffering, I mean, I wish that my mum was here. I still wish that she was here all the time, every single day. I wish at some point that mum, I could talk to her about something, or could go and see her, or could just walk into her kitchen. I've always had a fantasy about just walking into her kitchen, sitting down and talking to her, or her name being in my phone. But I wish the accident hadn't happened, but it did happen. You know, I can't live with the regret and sadness. I don't want to live with the regret and sadness. I want to acknowledge it, definitely. It's a huge, huge part of who I am. But it is also there. So accept it and accept it into your life, you know, and kind of embrace the challenges and the growth that it brings with it as well. And my husband having this accident last year it was a very, very unusual, freaky accident in a terrorist scare, and he broke both his legs very, very badly and his arm, and kind of facing up to a sort of another life-changing accident was really horrifying. But also, I think I felt quite accepting of it, actually. I haven't kind of tried to fight against the fact that it happened. It's happened. These things happen in life, you know. It happens. Let's work out the best way that we can deal with it and move on from it and make the best of it as well. And I hope that the children have seen me do that in the last few months, actually, what we went through. It was happened in November. And I think they've seen me and Pete together. He's had to learn to walk again. He was in a wheelchair for 6 months. And I think that's been quite a good example to them in a way, actually, of surviving and coping with stuff. You know, that ability to cope and kind of get on is a good, I hope it's a good sort of, yeah, good example that I've shown them.
It's one of the most important lessons, you know. Maths, spelling, kind of all pales into significance when it comes to sort of basic survival.
Yeah.
I wonder whether in the 21st century you've slightly lost sight of that. So it's a really great reminder.
Yeah.
Clover, thank you so much for coming to talk to me today. The Wild Other, as I mentioned, is just an amazing book.
Thank you.
I think it covers so many topics. So, you know, for me as a parent, it really resonated. There is one line in it which I remember reading and thinking that I could never articulate myself, but it made so much sense as my experience as a mother. You're describing the moment when Jimmy was born, your eldest, and you said he was born 5 days early, and you said the complete and absolute rightness of his existence flooded into my life like a pot of golden poster paint tipped all over a white floor. I just love it. I loved it so much. I have to kind of underline it, but I can't recommend the book highly enough. The Wild Other is available from Amazon and all good bookshops. Do follow Clover on Instagram. What's your Instagram? Is it?
It's clover.stroud.
Clover.stroud.
There are lots of children and ponies and book. I've put some book recommendations up there as well.
I love your book recommendations. But I think often when you read a powerful book, it's really nice to know a little bit more about the sort of the pictures and the you know, the colours behind the author. Thank you very much
thank
for listening.
You. It's been really nice talking to you.
And thank you for listening to the podcast. Please do remember to rate, review and subscribe. The more followers we have, the more easy it is for people to find us. But in the meantime, thank you for listening.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.